Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back my great guest co-host, Laurel Sisler. Welcome, Laurel.
Thank you.
You know, on our show today, Laurel, we're going to be talking with Dr. Gordon Schiff, internist and safety science director. I love that name, safety science director at Harvard Medical School, about indications on prescription drugs. Do you ever like wonder, like when you get your prescription drugs, it has like 100 million indications and perhaps the one that you're thinking that you're taking it for isn't on there?
I do, yeah. Yes, I do. And also, yeah, with patients who are often really concerned by a lot of those lengthy lists.
Right. You're taking medication, an antibiotic for like sinus, and it says taking it for a rare and fatal virus, you know, or something like that. Well, we're looking forward to that conversation. But first, we've actually got some really interesting research that matters. We get to talk about kind of physical activity and how does it compare to like smoking or high blood pressure. We're going to talk about pain without addiction. This relates to actually a conversation we had on a recent house call, a previous show, about surveys about doctors talking to patients about guns. I'll be curious about your thoughts on that. And finally, because we're not going to shy away from controversy, about marijuana and kids after kind of recreational use in Colorado. Let's dive right in and talk about physical capacity and smoking and kind of risk here.
So this research article is talking about
physical capacity.
Yeah. That being kind of the second only to smoking being the best predictor, or I guess the worst predictor of leading to early mortality.
Yeah, this
was my take on it.
Yeah, you're right. This was like almost 800 men. I love the name of the title, Study of Men Born in 1913. I quickly compute ages there. But 50-year-old men who were recruited in 1963, they were born in 1913, and they looked at, followed up, at different ages, and that some of them got stress tests at certain ages, and then they looked at their kind of oxygen uptake, and then they kind of eventually looked at follow-up exams up until 2012, when many of them would have been, you know, close to 100 years, and they had been followed, and they were looking at, you know, to what association these physical capacity and the exercise capacity predicted mortality, and then controlling for some of these other factors. And they found this kind of this ability to exercise was really strongly associated with rates of death, and as much or as strong as some of our established risk factors, really second only to smoking. Is that surprising to you?
Well, it reminds me of the phrase I've heard recently, sitting is the new smoking. And so I think it goes hand in hand with a lot of the other research about the benefits of being more active.
Yeah, this was in the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology. And I think increasingly we talk so much on the show about losing weight and reducing smoking and physical activity. And it's not all or none, right? You must give a couple tips on how people increase their physical activity.
Yeah, I mean, things as simple as parking your car further away, taking the stairs instead of the elevators. If you're not as mobile, doing chair exercises, swimming is a really wonderful thing if you're having joint issues.
Yeah, great. Well, let's talk about our next research that matters, about something else that I think is also really good, if not great, which is treating pain, chronic pain, without actually being on opioids, those kind of very strong pain medications that are very highly addiction. And this was actually published in the journal Addiction, and it was like a study of veterans. What kind of things were they even looking at here?
So they were looking at adding into an existing substance abuse treatment program, adding in or integrating really skills for dealing with chronic pain. And I think this is just so important because those two issues, chronic pain and substance abuse, go hand in hand. It's very promising that they found actually not only that pain was improved through this behavioral intervention using mostly cognitive behavioral therapy and acceptance and commitment therapy, but also that their substance use decreased. I thought that was particularly exciting.
Yeah, there were 10 weekly sessions, and the intensity of their pain decreased, their ability to function increased, and their alcohol use went down. These are like great things. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it was a forms of skill-based talk therapy, reflective therapy, supportive therapy. I don't think there's a real downside to that sort of therapy and a huge upside like decreased use of opioids and all these other positive benefits. This is exciting to me.
It is. Yeah. It's very exciting. I think this is an underutilized area where psychotherapy can be really helpful. I also think it is important to not to lose sight of the possibility of using things like methadone to help people with both chronic pain and addiction issues.
Yeah, I think we're going to have some more skills that we're going to need to have providers that are trained to really work with folks here, because this takes skills to teach people this cognitive behavioral and this commitment therapy. So really, really stay tuned. Speaking of staying tuned, our next Research That Matters is actually a national survey that really kind of asks patients, are they open to their doctors talking about guns and gun safety in the clinical room? And I think this is such an important issue. We probably want to do a show about this because, you know, there was a bill passed in Florida this past 1 or 2 years ago, which really, like, said physicians can't talk to their patients about gun safety. And Florida legislature passed it. It's kind of now working its way to the Supreme Court, which I think is like, well, what do patients think? What do we know about this?
I mean, this survey was saying about 65% of people indicated that it was at least sometimes appropriate for their provider to talk to them about guns. I think that's shocking that about 35% think that it's, I mean, I don't know if I'm extrapolating correctly here, but, you know, 35% think that it's never okay to talk about guns in a clinical setting. And that's scary as somebody who's trained in kind of assessing for suicide ideation and things like that. That wouldn't be something that I would ever consider.
Right. And for context, they also asked in this research that was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, they asked for context, you know, what's it like to ask patients, be asked about seatbelts? And, you know, 80% said, yeah, talk to me about seatbelts. That also suggests that up to 20% said, don't even talk to me about seatbelts. And like seatbelts today are kind of like, you know, let's just talk about, should you stand in the middle of the road and get hit by a car? No, can I talk to you about not doing that? You know,
it might be indicative of a larger just kind of privacy concern, maybe.
Right. I think so. But I think we increasingly see roles that providers play today that perhaps they didn't play a decade ago. And when we're talking about 20,000 suicides in the United States, another 10,000 homicides, it becomes one of the top 10 public health problems of our day. Boy, you can tell where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
You probably don't disagree too much.
No, not at all.
Well, let's talk about our very last research that matters, which talks about marijuana really kind of exposure among kind of children after recreational marijuana use was legalized in Colorado. And this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty journal, Pediatrics. And you, Laura, like myself and others, we follow what's happening in Colorado, and we understand the legalization of medical marijuana in 4 other states now. And I guess this is, what happens? What's maybe some unintended consequences of this? Is it anything that we should be concerned about? What do you think?
That's exactly what I thought of when I read this article, was this may be one of the unintended consequences that we really need to pay attention to. And to me is really alarming that children and teenagers may be more likely to use marijuana earlier and perhaps more frequently.
And what they actually saw was increase of these kind of children, young children being admitted to the hospital, having poisonings, and all kinds of pediatric marijuana exposures, usually infused edible products. These products weren't in child-resistant packages, poor child supervision, product storage issues, all kinds of things that probably could be helped with regulation. So this is a story, I think, of regardless of how one feels about whether that practice of legalization is good or not, that we want to make it safer when it happens.
Yeah. And I think you have to think about the increase in THC levels in marijuana over the last 40 years. It's not the pot that it used to be.
Yeah, good point. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters, Laurel, and we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be able to have a conversation that I recently had with Dr. Gordon Schiff, internist and safety science director at Harvard Medical School, about indications on prescription drugs. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Wilson and Laurel Sisso. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, I'm talking with Dr. Gordon Schiff, internist, safety science director, researcher, advocate at Harvard Medical School, about indications on prescription drugs. Welcome, Dr. Schiff, to Your Health.
Thank you.
We are so thrilled to actually have a conversation with you about something that I think people take for granted, and it's like I call intuitively obvious, but it's not intuitively easy. And we'll kind of explore some of those things. But first, I want to understand a little bit more about you. How did you become interested in patient safety? I don't think people go to medical school and say, I'm going to be one of the world's experts in patient safety.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think probably a lot of different forces came together. When we were in medical school, we were given very strong promotional messages about medications, and as we advanced in our training, we learned that medicines, have risks and benefits, and people need to think about drugs cautiously and carefully. And I can tell you about two patients, for example, that I saw when I was an intern. This new drug had come out that was a totally natural drug. It was a purine analog drug for gout, and it had no side effects. And this drug was called allopurinol. And in the course of my internship, I saw two patients die from TEN. They turned red as alligators and high fevers, and they died, and their kidneys failed. So here was a drug that had no side effects. It was a designer drug. And so as you, of course, any experienced physician learns to respect both the benefits as well as potential risks of drugs. And one thing we learned is as you go through adverse drug reactions and problems people have is that sometimes it's because there's an error. Somebody's allergic to penicillin and they got it anyway. Or I remember a very vivid case actually that died of a sulfa allergy, and they were allergic to sulfa drugs, so they were given Bactrim, right? There's no sulfa. We called it Sceptre or Bactrim. And of course, we didn't have electronic systems to cross-check in those days. So it's clear that certain amount of harm from drugs was actually being related to errors. And of course, these are not intentional errors, but these are things that systems, as we look at them, are kind of setting us up for in terms of, if, for example, if there's not an electronic system that cross-checks if somebody's allergic to penicillin. We did a study actually when I was a director at my clinic that the pharmacy had the records of people who were allergic actually was in their early electronic computer, and then we had the paper charts. Said allergic to penicillin in the pharmacy in the paper chart, but not in the pharmacy computer. So, we saw several problems there. So, I guess I just had an increasing awareness, and then my personal experience came together with what was called, I think, the growing patient safety movement that really culminated in the Air is Human and Crossing the Quality Chasm, and the efforts to try to make healthcare safer. And then the final thing I'll mention is that I've actually taken my interest in medication safety and tried to apply it to diagnosis safety. And that's actually been a big challenge and a swamp. Maybe we'll come back and talk about this in a future time, this Institute of Medicine report on diagnosis error. I'm sure you probably covered in your past programs. But these are all important issues, and they all come together around thinking about how we can change the infrastructure to make, in this case, we're talking about medicine, prescribing safer. And I think that's what brings us to the indications issue that you want to raise today, which we've recently published a commentary in New England Journal about.
Yes, exactly. And that's what a great introduction. And, one of the things before we kind of dive right into one of the things that was one of the first things I learned when I was writing prescriptions, which is, okay, you write the drug, you write the number, you write a SIG, you write an indication of use. But they kind of said, yeah, it'd be nice to put why you're using it, but it wasn't kind of like forced on us. So we're going to get to that. But I want you to start off by saying you define kind of what I found really useful, the five rights for safe medication ordering, and then you add in the sixth one. Can you just review what you mean by that?
Well, in patient safety and medication safety, there's an awareness that these five rights have to the right patient, the right drug, and of course we know that people can accidentally put the wrong patient's name, especially if you're having a pull-down menu or two patients open it not once, or, you know, I want to order penicillin and I hit penicillamine. Okay, we've had many orders like that. You know, just it's right next to it on a pull-down menu. So you want to have these, of course, the dose you, instead of, you know, 0.25 of digoxin, you don't want to write 250 milligrams of digoxin. So these are kinds of errors, decimal point errors, wrong name errors. And so to these five rights, we think another one that is missing is the right indication and making sure that the indication matches the drug you've chosen. So just to give you an example and to orient your listeners, you know, so if I order hydralazine, hydroxyzine and hydralazine are a drug pair that 25 milligrams are easily mixed up. We see a lot of errors historically. These are two very common old-fashioned generic drugs.
Hydralazine for high blood pressure and hydroxyzine for itching.
That's right. So if I were to write itching and, you know, I write hydralazine, then a pharmacist could just spot that as that's, there's a mistake there. Or even a more practical example is here you take allopurinol twice a day for gout, and the patient goes to the pharmacy and, or, you know, either they carry that paper prescription or they get it on the bottle, and the person says, wait a minute, I don't have gout. And so obviously something is wrong. So we're trying to match the drug, the indication, and the patient. And, you know, when there's a mismatch, that can be a clue, a warning, a cross-check to say that there's a potential medication error. From the safety standpoint, that's first and foremost why we're very keen on trying to make this part of the way we prescribe.
But isn't it even bigger than that? You lay out some really interesting, I think, thoughts about, this clearly can only improve safety, but it also improves a lot of other patient outcomes. And I know you study patient outcomes. Why is that important?
Of course, safety is a serious and important patient outcome. And by the way, you made one statement that I'll even just to enrich the conversation, say that nobody's ever asked you or required you to put in the indication. Believe it or not, for decades, pharmacists have really done everything they can to lobby to get the doctor to put the indication in. So certainly back when the prescriptions were written in paper, they wanted you to write, you know, take twice a day for blood pressure or for gout. And the doctors, the physicians in general, were not keen on this. It was extra work. They raised confidentiality issues. But I think in the end, I think it's really in some ways was a workflow issue. And pharmacists even went to the point, and I can't tell you how many states, but there were a number of states where the pharmacy board said that we were requiring the prescription to have the indication on the prescription. And unfortunately, the adherence of physicians to that, those regulations was poor and ultimately kind of fell by the wayside. But we think actually the opportunity is really ripe. The timing is right. Nobody has to write any extra words on with their pen on a piece of paper. But we think if we can really do this right and make it easy in the computer, and we'll come back to some of our ideas of how to do that, it could actually not only be not extra time and extra work to add the indication, it could actually save the doctor time and work. So to answer your question, we came up in this article and we've in our other writings with multiple reasons, in addition to safety, which we again say is number one, and this multiple other reasons why I think this could be a really a beneficial thing for the way we prescribe and use drugs.
Well, we're going to need to actually take a short break, but I think when we come back, I do want to go into some of these things because I think there, again, it's like, oh, yeah, that's obvious. Why aren't we doing it? Which will be kind of what we want to come back to. But we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Gordon Schiff, internist and science safety director at Harvard Medical School, about indications on prescription drugs.
Yeah, it's actually the Center for Primary Care. I have played a role in our primary care center, and I'm also the associate chair of the Center for Patient Safety Research at Brigham and Women's Hospital. So don't promote me to titles that I don't deserve.
You probably deserve a promotion, but we'll be right back with your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info.
working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health. We've been talking with Dr. Gordon Schiff, Associate Director for the Center for Patient Safety Research and Practice at Brigham Hospital, and physician, Harvard Medical School, about indications on prescription drugs. And right before the break, Dr. Schiff, you really had really started laying out what I believe in your article is a really compelling argument, not only by putting the indication for why a patient's using a drug on the prescription improves safety, it really is empowering. Tell us how it's empowering to patients and why that's important.
In quite simple language, if patients don't know why they're taking their medicine, they really are going to get them mixed up. They can't ask questions about the medication. So every day I see patients, they have 6 or 10 pill bottles. They say, I don't know what medicine's for which. Some of them just stop taking all of them or some of them. You know, somebody says, I stopped taking my diabetes medicine because I didn't like it, or my depression medicine, but it was their diabetes medicine. So having this is really an important empowerment thing. It turns out patients adhere to their medicines better if the indication, I mean, if you know why you're taking it, that's important for that. So patients should be able to question, do I still need this for my headaches? They're better. So this is number one. I think I'll run through the list of some of the other compelling reasons. Medication reconciliation. This is sort of getting people's med list organized and discontinuing duplicate meds or meds that people don't need anymore. Most of us are looking at these lists. They're like alphabetized lists. So here you have like allopurinol on the top. We use that drug. And then Zilprim is on the bottom. Of course, that's the same drug, generic and brand names. So if all the gout medicines came together and the blood pressure, it would be so much easier to sort of say, okay, let's see what you're taking for gout. Let's see what you're taking for blood pressure. And all this is right on their list. Much better organized, especially like if you want to discontinue a medicine with medication reconciliation. You know, people are on all these medicines, like, why are you taking this? Maybe we can stop this. If you don't know why it was started, you're going to be a little gun-shy in stopping a medicine that another doctor started, even if it was a long time ago. But if you're clearly oriented to the reason and you can discuss that with the patient, that's quite empowering, actually, for both the doctor and the patient, and makes life easier is medication reconciliation. But I'm going to mention one other one, drugs of choice. So I want to prescribe for H. pylori infection. Somebody has a ulcer and it's proven to be that, or somebody comes in with gonorrhea. So what's the current CDC drug of choice for gonorrhea? You know, it keeps changing. The resistance patterns change. I'm going to maybe look it up on the CDC website, the STD section. Why can't I just write GC into the computer? And it would actually tell me the drug of choice. And maybe it would even come up allergic to penicillin. This is the drug of second choice if there's a penicillin drug as first choice, for example. So the computer really should be helping us. And if we start with the indication, and even we could click on the problem. So somebody has hypertension, I click on that problem, and then it gives us the recommended drug or for migraine. And so this would actually help us. I think physicians certainly don't want to be told what to do and have their clinical autonomy, their prescribing autonomy taken away. But frankly, I actually do need help. I think that drugs are many more new drugs these days and frequent, and I think it's helpful for me to have suggested drug of choice, especially if it makes my computer life easier, that I'm just clicking on the default that's suggested to me or maybe some other alternatives that are right on the screen. And they could be smart suggestions. You know, it should know if somebody's already been tried on a certain drug for blood pressure and it's failed, then it wouldn't suggest that one again to me. It would suggest the second line or the third line drug. So we see this once you start with the indication, then the computer could really be much more helpful in pointing you to where you want to be prescribing.
Yeah, this seems so, again, really common sense and so important. And I guess one of the questions is, you know where we need to go, and I know you just got a 3-year project that you're investigating kind of how you can do this and really disseminate that, and I hope we play a very small role in facilitating that. It would seem to me in one ways, if this becomes a quality measure for physician performance like many other quality metrics, it starts to happen. Are we going to do that?
You know, poor physicians are sort of quality metric to death. we don't forget about the quality metric. Let's just make this the way that the computer prescribing systems work. So rather than me saying I'm going to measure how often you do this and make you do this and incentivize you to do this, again I'm being very overly dramatic here in this language. Let's just make it so that's the default. So when I go to order a drug, I type in the indication or I click on the problem, and it's just done. So make it easier for me to do the right thing. You don't have to keep track of me whether I'm doing it or not, because it would just be automatic.
And what? How close are we to having that be real time? Because it should happen yesterday.
Three steps away, two or three steps. So currently in like my EMR, I can go to a... It's actually a separate screen I have to flip to and check the indication. So that's sort of an extra step. You could say that's easier than typing it in, and they're all predefined. So it's, you know, if I'm prescribing ampicillin, it will have the list of, you know, ear infection will be in there and sinusitis, whatever. So we're thinking of something that would be a really sort of a redesigned workflow where you would actually not start with the drug but start with the indication. What we've built in the process of building is a prototype where it just would be sort of a simulated program where we demonstrate how this could really be working smarter. And we have, you know, very modest resources. We're not like a big computer vendor. But with some of the academic people sitting around the table, the human factors people and the physicians, and we're testing this with physicians, I think we're going to come up with a smarter prototype. And I know you have a radio show, but anybody who wants to see it, we could probably refer you to a website where we're going to have a demonstration of this. And I think so we're going to create sort of the model of how to do this, a prototype, and then the next thing would be how to integrate it into these EMRs. There's some new standards that allow, even if you have like a mainframe EMR where you could put a module on top of it that would allow you to prescribe in this way. So these are kind of the two or three steps that I think would get us there. I think, again, where there's a will, there's a way. So hopefully your listeners can be part of saying, boy, this is what we need. This is what we want. I need that kind of help in choosing my drugs. I don't want the pharmacy to keep calling me to ask me why the patient's on the medicine. It'll be there ready. I need medication reconciliation to be easier. And again, the whole safety thing, I think if you look at the data, you won't need convincing that this is, you know, going to be a way of helping avoid wrong drug errors. I'm not going to pick penicillamine when I'm prescribing for strep pharyngitis.
Yeah, a drug that's not designed for treating
it. Wouldn't
that
even show me penicillamine. You know, yeah. It wouldn't even be there, yeah, because it knows my indication is not.
Right.
That's not on the list of right, approved drugs to use for.
I do say that I know that if you need a beta site, I can imagine all my colleagues here would love this is like one we've been waiting for, and we know, and we'd be really behind. But I guess
all right, we're taking you up on this. I guess this is now on the air, so we have to hold you to this, right? We'd love to work with you
absolutely.
The paper is the New England Journal. If people want to email me, we're very eager to work with really practicing physicians, because you know, the pharmacists don't need any convincing. They're very much on record. I think we want to get the physicians to really understand that this is really a benefit to them, not extra work, not Big Brother tracking metrics, but really it's a way of making it easier to do the right thing and
yep,
and default to the right drugs.
Well, we really appreciate your passion. And I guess in the last 30 seconds, if you could leave our listeners with one final point about anything we've discussed today, what would it be?
Actually, if somebody's interested in more detail, we have, it's called Chain Online. If you Google AHRQ Chain Online and maybe my name, SCHIFF, there's a series of six webinars. They're 90 minutes each, but or seven of them, actually. The last one, we actually showed an early version of this prototype, and of course, a lot of the background information about what we're attempting to do in this project. I'd really urge people to go check out that website, and if they want to learn more, and of course, please get in touch with us if you'd also like more information.
Well, and we will certainly be linking those websites to our website, so when we folks can certainly go and look at that. And we really, really appreciate the work that you're doing, Dr. Schiff, improving patient safety, lifelong pursuit professionally, and certainly having great success. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you for your interest in reaching out on this.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. And if you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question today. Laura?
I recently went to my doctor for a physical. I'm 65 and pretty healthy. I have a slight blood pressure elevation, but it's really well controlled with medication. My cholesterol didn't seem to get any higher or really be any different, but I got a note from my doctor saying that she thought I should start cholesterol medication because I had a 12% risk of having a heart attack in the next 10 years. However, that doesn't seem too high to me because that means I also have an 88% risk of not having a heart attack. What are your thoughts?
Wow, what a great question. And what an interesting way of understanding. You know, first off, I wonder if you got this correspondence through a letter, through a patient portal, or through a telephone call. Which of those do you actually like doctors to communicate when you hear from doctors, Laura?
I really am liking the patient portal methodology recently to get in touch with my doctor. I find that it gets some responses really quickly. So, you know, you don't always understand, you don't hear the inflection in someone's voice with that, but I think that in terms of efficiency, that's really helpful.
Yeah, and this is one of those cases where the doctor could have been really efficient in communicating some important information, but I also wonder, this is one of those cases where there needs to be a conversation. Clearly, our listener, our questioner, our patient has some really valid issues they're raising, which is, okay, you've given me information here, and it says that my risk is higher than some threshold. And what they're talking about here is the kind of new guidelines out that really help give physicians more information to say, oh, you know, cardiovascular disease remains the number one cause of preventable death. And at these ages, it will still even outpace, in particularly this case, cancer for this patient because the patient may not have a lot of risk factors, at least not that we've heard of. And so how do we prevent that? And if the risk goes above a certain element, and it's certainly 10%, then that most people would say, or at least doctors would say, oh, nowadays you should at least consider this. But the patient brings up a good point. It's not like absolute, and we have values. And I imagine you appreciate a doctor respecting your values.
Or at least having a conversation. It's really sometimes hard as a layperson or, you know, the patient to know exactly what that means in everyday people terms. So it's nice when a doctor's willing to have the conversation with you and explain to you why that's as important as they may think it is.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
My father was recently in the emergency room, and the doctor said his blood pressure was dangerously high. They gave him more medication to lower it, and in passing, they asked him how much he drinks. He said he has 3 to 5 drinks on average a day. However, it seems like, to me, that he drinks 5 drinks a day, and many of those are doubles. The doctor didn't say much about it, but it seems like this may be the biggest problem of all. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I would agree with you on that one. This is a raises an interesting issue, which is, you know, the emergency room is about really, in most cases, trying to make sure people are safe and getting that kind of an initial triage decision going here. And clearly the blood pressure was too high and they felt that whatever symptoms the patient came into the emergency room with, whether it's thinking a little bit off or could have been a TIA, what's called a little cell mini stroke or something that probably chest pain that brought the patient in with the blood pressure. But we could treat the blood pressure. We could treat, you know, the symptom, but not really the whatever's driving that symptom here. And in this particular case, I've seen so many times too much alcohol use, alcohol abuse, substance abuse going on here. And I think the physicians actually asked about it, which I give them credit. A lot of times the emergency room, they may not have had time or really addressed it. It'd be one of those things you really hope the physician had talked with the doctor. I suspect, Laura, if you had a loved one, is it so easy to perhaps contact the provider?
I guess it depends on your relationship with the loved one and how fraught that is. But it brings up an interesting question. You know, as a doctor, I'm sure you have to rely on self-reported data all the time. And if your patients don't give you the accurate data, then they're putting you in a tough spot in terms of their care. So I don't know. It would be really hard if a loved one didn't own up to that.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm always appreciative to have more information. There is, we know, the HIPAA and protection of confidentiality, and it, you know, kind of forbids me from releasing information without express consent, but it doesn't mean that others can't share things that they're concerned about. And I'm always, you know, because this is coming in this particular case probably out of love. It's not, it doesn't seem like there's another motive there. And likely I'm going to have a more serious conversation about alcohol use the next visit if this were a patient that I was seeing, and I hope the doctor would have one, because if you don't, no matter what you do with the blood pressure, this problem is going to continue. And I think we always want to create win-win-wins here for the patient, for the family, and the doctor-patient relationship. Thanks so much for that question. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm diabetic and have been on insulin for several years. I've also been working to lose weight, but it seems like the insulin is a problem. I'm thinking of stopping the insulin because my blood sugar seems well controlled. My therapist says this is not a good idea and that I should talk with my doctor. I know my doctor will say no, but I really want to get off the insulin. What do you think?
Well, I think your therapist is right in this particular case. As a matter of fact, I think you may need to go back and talk with the therapist, because there's a whole really interesting question at play here, which is, you know, your diabetes is doing well and it's well controlled, probably because you're on insulin and the doctor's regulating it, or the doctor and the pharmacist are regulating it well enough to get it well controlled. And that clearly is going to help protect you against all of the complications of diabetes, from kidney problems to heart problems to stroke problems to neuropathy, when it's really well controlled. At the same token, I do hear your concern about weight issues, and insulin can do that, which then leads us to finally this idea that weight loss might actually get you off the insulin or get that insulin down. And that's where I would really put most of my effort as a provider and working with your therapist and others to help you actually lose weight to reduce the need for insulin. But I would not stop the insulin. I don't think Christy Page, my other co-host, would ever really agree with that without really strictly following really, really closely. Thanks for your question. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I've noticed over the past few weeks that when I take my first few steps in the morning, I get a stabbing pain in my heel. It hasn't been going away, and I'm wondering if you have any ideas what it is and how I could make it go away.
Well, thank you for that question. And I must say, anyone in the audience out there, raise your hand if you've never had pain on your heels when you get up in the morning. This is a common problem. I don't know, Laura. I mean, all of us, you know, after I've walked a few miles, sometimes the next morning, I'm a little bit sore, at least mm-hmm. anyone over the age of 25. And you're about maybe a year over that, Laura.
Thanks. maybe a little bit more, but I'll take it.
And so it raises the question here. One of the concerns is about a condition called plantar fasciitis, or this inflammation of the tissue on the bottom of the feet. And Christy and I have talked about this many times on the show. And that's a tissue. Sometimes the serious people have flat feet, don't have the right shoes. They don't have inserts with arch support in the shoes. We also can worry about heel spurs, and that can be an issue. So a lot of times when I end up seeing a patient, sometimes a podiatrist, sometimes doing exercise, physical therapy, sometimes medications, a whole host of things, weight loss, maybe if it's indicated here, stretching exercises for the feet, lots of things that can be helpful. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank everyone for joining us for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you, and you can email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. My great guest today, Dr. Gordon Schiff. And we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.